and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the intensifying battle between the FBI and Apple over finding a way to unlock the encryption on an iPhone belonging to the San Bernardino terrorist. Ross Shulman, the Senior Policy Counsel at the New America Foundation's Open Technology Institute, joins us to discuss the extent to which the FBI brought this problem on themselves by foolishly resetting the phone's iCloud password, thus losing the ability to see the phone's content, and are now browbeating Apple to bail them out of a problem they created. We'll also assess where we stand in the battle between security and privacy now that the government is asking for a key to unlock everyone's private information inside their phones that largely contain a complete roadmap of their life. Then we'll examine Wall Street's alarm at the rise of Bernie Sanders and his appeal to young voters and their concern that Sanders is driving Hillary Clinton further to the left so that at the end of the day, if she wins the presidency, she will be committed to a reform agenda and policies unfriendly to the 1%. William K. Black, a professor of economics and law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and a founding member of Bank Whistleblowers United, joins us to discuss his article at the Huffington Post, Wall Street's Message to Young Adults, You Are Clueless. Then finally, we will speak with David Woodard, a professor of political science at Clemson University and author of The New Southern Politics. He is also a political consultant for Republican candidates, and we will discuss the latest spat between Rubio and Cruz, who today had to fire his communications director for doctoring a video of Rubio walking past Cruz's father, Rafael, who was reading the Bible, so that the subtitles misquoted Rubio's remark to have Rubio saying, "There are not many answers in the Bible." We'll also look into next Saturday's Democratic primary race. And joining us now is Ross Shulman, who's a senior policy counsel at the New America Foundation's Open Technology Institute, where he focuses on cybersecurity, encryption, surveillance, and internet governance. Previously, he worked for Google and also at the Computer and Communications Industry Association, the Center for Democracy and Technology, and on Capitol Hill for Senators Wyden and Feingold. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ross Shulman.
Hi, good evening. Pleasure to be with you.
And this standoff between Apple and the FBI, my understanding is that a part of the problem here is that the FBI screwed up and that they foolishly reset the phone belonging to the terrorist responsible for the massacres in San Bernardino. They reset the phone's iCloud password. And therefore, you know, they've lost the ability to see the phone's content. And now they seem to be browbeating Apple for mistakes that they've made.
So we saw a conversation sort of playing out over the weekend between a sort of a three, but Apple on one side, the FBI on another side of the triangle, and then the whose phone it actually is on this. Everyone sort of figures it, everybody else. You know, well, they screwed this up. They screwed this up. You know, I think what we seem to understand has happened here is that you're exactly right that the password for the iCloud was changed sort of not long after the FBI took custody of the phone. And why that's important is Apple at least says that if they could take the iPhone and get it to a network that it trusts, so a Wi-Fi network that the iPhone has used before that it trusts, then they could get it to sort of do a backup as long as the password hadn't been changed. But since the password had been changed, basically the phone would no longer trust, or I guess the other way around, that the iCloud service would no longer trust the phone because the password was no longer correct. So that's what we're hearing is happening, at least in this particular instance, yeah.
So why did the FBI change the password then?
Well, you know, that's a question you'd have to ask the FBI. You know, there's probably a number of different reasons. The one that comes to mind as a possibility, again, you know, I don't know, is that they were perhaps worried that if someone else had the iCloud password that was sort of working with one of the shooters, that they could then go in and do a remote wipe of the machine of the iPhone itself from the iCloud service. I believe that's possible. And so that could be one thing that they were worried about preventing. But again, you know, we don't know. It could be a simple, they could have a good reason, or it could be just a simple mistake, you know?
And the other aspect that I'd heard apparently doesn't apply here, that there was a fingerprint password protection and that somehow they either hadn't gotten a fingerprint from the corpse or the person was buried before they had the chance. That, my understanding is that this is an older version of the phone that didn't have that fingerprint feature.
Right, and so it may not have had the fingerprint feature, and also, you know, you don't have to turn on the fingerprint feature. So if it's not turned on, then it's all you can do is plug in a PIN. And so if that wasn't turned on, then the fingerprint wouldn't have done them any good.
I see. So what is this issue then involved with you only have 10 chances of getting it right and then it automatically erases all of the data? That's what they're up against now. And when they changed the password, what did they do to that feature?
So we're talking about two different passwords. That's a really good question and one that sort of confused a fair number of people. So there's two different passwords involved. There's the key code that you have to put in when you unlock the phone every time you do it, and that's usually between 4 and 6 digits, usually just numerical, though it can be alphanumeric. And it's the one that you put in every time you unlock the phone. There's a second password that we're talking about, and that's the one that got reset. The second password is the one that that sort of gets you into your iCloud account. So iCloud has a lot of different services, and it can be logged into from a lot of different places, not just your phone. So if you have a Mac laptop, for example, you can also log into your iCloud account from there as well. And those passwords, you can imagine, are going to be sort of longer and more complex because you're oftentimes typing them on a keyboard instead of on, you know, a little bitty phone, right, with your thumbs. And so that's the password that was reset, and that handles stuff like backups of the phone, so, you know, your photos and stuff like that, and your contacts and your messages. It also handles, in some cases, you know, an email account can be associated with it, for example. So that's the password that got reset, and the one that the FBI is asking Apple to help them break is the one that unlocks the phone every time you do it. That's the 4 to 6-digit numeric password that is on the phone itself.
And again, I'm speaking with Ross Shulman, who's a senior policy counsel at the New Americas Foundation's Open Technology Institute, where he focuses on cybersecurity, encryption, surveillance, and internet governance. Previously, he worked for Google, also worked at the Computer and Communications Industry Association, the Center for Democracy and Technology, and on Capitol Hill for Senators Wyden and Feingold. So how would you say then, Ross, this sort of eternal battle, if you will, between privacy and security that goes back to Benjamin Franklin's adage that he who would trade temporary privacy for temporary security deserves neither. Where do we stand in this? Because obviously to many people, this seems like a no-brainer, and particularly the people out in San Bernardino, not far from where I'm talking to you, they and some of the families of the victims are all saying, wait a minute, you know, you're not helping us catch a terrorist. This just makes no sense whatsoever. And of course, the FBI has floated the idea that Apple is essentially protecting its marketing advantage, which I believe the CEO, Tim Cook, has taken exception to.
So, you know, oftentimes people talk about that very sort of old battle that you've referred to as a sort of a balancing act between privacy and on one hand and security on the other. And I think one of the really interesting things that this sort of court case between Apple and the FBI really brings out is that that's not actually a really useful metaphor anymore. The balancing act metaphor is still quite valid, but actually, really interestingly, what we're balancing today is less privacy versus security and more security versus security, right? And so on the one hand, you have your sort of really traditional old national security police effort to protect people and their property. And that's obviously important. On the other hand, what you have these days is not just the old concept of privacy that, like, you might think of as embedded within the Fourth Amendment, but really a sense of security in the digital sense, and a real effort that to protect the digital lives that we are all building today. So every one of us, well, most of us at least, have today this phone in our pockets that, honestly, the computing power of that phone could have landed the Apollo astronauts on the moon. Like, that's the level that we're dealing with here, the intense change that we've experienced since the 1960s and 70s. And so we take those devices that we have in our pockets all the time, and we imbue our lives into them, right? And we have everything from, you know, our emails and our text messages all the way through, you know, my bank account is associated with my phone. I can log in and check my health records on my phone. Everything about my life is in there. And the security of all of that information is intensely important to me, and I think to a lot of different people. And so we are faced today with a very important challenge to secure that information. One of the ways that we do that, and one of the primary ways in which we do that, is through the security, the very security devices on these phones that the FBI is asking Apple to subvert in this case. And so it's really important to note that, at least from our point of view, that this is not just about the one iPhone in the San Bernardino case. And so I completely understand the view of the victims in San Bernardino, that they want to see terrorism and atrocious acts like this that even aren't terrorism investigated and prosecuted. But this is not about the one iPhone. It's about all of our iPhones. And not only that, it's about all of our digital devices. So I don't use an iPhone. I happen to have an Android phone. But the same idea applies, right? And so it applies to that. It applies to our laptops. It applies to all of the smart Internet of Things devices that are about to invade our lives, sort of whether we think that's a great idea or not. So it's about your refrigerator now. It's about the baby monitor that you buy that hooks up to the Internet. It's about all of these various connected devices in which security is going to be so fundamental.
But some of the national security people argue, of course, that encryption only came after Edward Snowden's revelations, and this is a relatively new thing. So when you say, and quite accurately, there's no question about it, that because of the extraordinary power of the little iPhone that people carry around with them, more computing power than that they had to go to the moon, and I think by a huge factor, as a matter of fact, the fact that this is like a walking Fourth Amendment, everything's in there. Everything about you and your life is in that little thing that you carry around with you. And most people have a against their ear, for most of the day, it would seem. So I get that part of it. But prior to Snowden, there wasn't this concern. So how vulnerable were we before this? And is this a case of now that Snowden's alerted people, the protections are in there, but they weren't there only a few years ago?
So I think, you know, I would quibble a little bit with that construction. I think the Snowden revelations were clearly a wake-up call for a lot of people that the rabbit hole sort of goes deeper than we thought it did, right? However, I do think that before this all started, before the Snowden revelations, that is, we still saw plenty of people who were worried about the sort of security of our device. I think they were just worried about it for reasons that didn't include the NSA, necessarily. Some people were sort of beating this drum going back even into the 90s. I mean, you had NSA leakers before Snowden, although they're not sort of as well. I think, by and large, the concept that digital security is important is one that the populace at large has sort of been waking up to gradually over a longer timeline, say a decade or maybe even a decade and a half. I mean, if you look at the stats, for example, at the Federal Trade Commission, when they take in complaints from the public, the number one complaint for a decade plus now has been identity theft. It's been, I think it's 12 or 13 years now running or something to that effect, that has been the number one complaint. So even prior to Snowden, the populace at large was very aware of this issue, of the problems inherent in digital security, and we're complaining to their government about it. So I think it's not quite right to say that the Snowden revelations are the sole driving force here. Although I definitely think you're right that they sort of were a wake up call for many people.
Well, I mean, surely phones get lost, phones get stolen. I mean, there's a good reason, surely, to have a protection. And
what we know is, that when phones get lost and stolen, they are sent to exactly one place, and that's China, and that the data that is on them is absolutely ripped off of there and used for criminal purposes before the phone is then resold on the black market in China. We know that that's true.
So how can the Chinese do it and the FBI not do it?
Well, that's exactly. So I suppose I should say we knew that was true a while ago, and stories like that are exactly why Apple has put in the protections that are at issue right now.
I see. So again, you continue to make a strong case for Apple. So what would you say to those family members in San Bernardino who lost their loved ones?
It's a hard question, you know.
I know it's not your responsibility in any way, but I'm just asking you to be the advocate for the other argument.
Right, and you know, I think the argument the other argument is definitely revolves around trying to make sure that if this is a power that the FBI is going to use, and I want to be clear that I actually don't believe that it should be, but if it is going to be a power that the FBI is going to be allowed to use, I think a couple things need to happen. First of all, it shouldn't happen under a 200-plus-year-old law that in no way, shape, or form could have anticipated the 21st century or the challenges that we would face that are inherent in the court case that we're seeing right now. And I'm referring to the All Writs Act, which is the sort of authorizing statute that the FBI is using in this case. I think that if this is a decision, if this is a thing that's going to happen, if this is the power that we're going to give the FBI, it needs to happen through transparent, open, democratic channels. It's something that the Congress needs to investigate, and it should not be wholly within the power of a single magistrate judge out in California.
Well, then, just in the last minute, Ross Shulman, how do you think this is going to work out? Because this is, you know, a real standoff, and you've got a very powerful, wealthy company on the one hand, and of course Google and Facebook are all joining in support of Apple. But then you've also got, you know, the FBI and this whole national security lobby in this post, you know, 9/11 world of the war on terror.
You know, I think it's too early to say right now. The funny thing about the All Writs Act is that the legal standard that is sort of underpins it is this concept of unduly burdensome. And so Apple will likely have to show. Well, Apple will probably make a number of arguments, but one of the arguments that they will have to show is that the request that the FBI is making is unduly burdensome, and that's a very fact-specific, as us lawyers like to say, claim. And so without knowing a lot of the details of what Apple is going to argue in their filing that they will make, I think it's this week, it's very hard to say who's going to come out ahead. What I do know is that this is probably going to be a very long process. It will not be sorted out at this sort of lowest court level. It will be whoever wins in this first court will undoubtedly appeal it. So we can look forward to many long months of doing interviews like this.
Well, on that note, Ross Shulman, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks very much for having me. It's great to talk to you.
And again, I've been speaking with Ross Shulman, who's a senior policy counsel at the New America Foundation's Open Technology Institute, where he focuses on cybersecurity, encryption, surveillance, and internet governance. Previously worked for Google and also worked for the Computer and Communications Industry Association, the Center for Democracy and Technology, and on Capitol Hill for Senators Wyden and Feingold. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking at Wall Street's alarm at the rise of Bernie Sanders and his appeal to young voters.
Looking for a sign. I'm looking for the treason that I knew in 65. Beware, the South is yours. Oh, 1984. Seek and seek, remember me.
Yeah, you got it on my movie road. You said it would last, but I guess we grow. You receive, but always want more.
But the day is coming, the day is near, the day is coming, you know what I mean. The day is...
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is William K. Black, a professor of economics and law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and the former litigation director of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, who investigated the savings and loan disaster of the 1980s. A white-collar criminologist, he is a founding member of Bank Whistleblowers United and the author of the best-selling book, The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. He has an article at the Huffington Post, Wall Street's Message to Young Adults, You Are Clueless. Welcome to Background Briefing, William K. Black.
Thank you. Good to be back.
And it does seem that Hillary Clinton is a bit mystified why the young people, and particularly young women, aren't supporting her and supporting Bernie Sanders instead. But from your article about what this Wall Street CEO has said in the Wall Street Journal, it's pretty clear that they're alarmed. Wall Street are alarmed. They're terrified of Bernie Sanders, but they're also worried that Bernie Sanders is going to push Hillary Clinton to the left, and maybe that she'll be forced, if she becomes president, to regulate Wall Street.
That's precisely the fear. They've been listening to her, and she has, in fact, moved, at least in her words, very substantially to the left throughout this campaign. And yes, Wall Street is terrified of Bernie Sanders, not just that he might be elected, but that he has really galvanized the youth and that having this effect on Hillary.
So are they, I mean, it sounds, as you point out, Bill Black, that it's Wall Street that's clueless. I mean, how could you not understand that the young people today, the millennials, who are laden with student debt, are facing extremely tenuous job prospects, in debt before they even get a job, and some living at home because they can't afford rent and cars, etc., and they're angry that, you know, the American dream is just a farce. It's a cruel joke to them.
Well, and this particular column by this Wall Street CEO was, as you say, it did demonstrate that he was clueless because he put in this article that he didn't get it. Why are people upset that Wall Street was about to work with business to destroy 75 million American jobs over the next two decades?
Well, but this narrative is I know Bernie Sanders has picked up on it, but Donald Trump has run away with it. I mean, he was the only candidate that I could remember that referred to the recent job loss of a big air conditioning company, Carrier, moving to Mexico. And there was a viral video of the spokesman for the company telling the workers that, I'm sorry, your jobs have been outsourced to Mexico. And this spokesperson was kind of upset that the workers booed him. You know, it was like some sort of insubordination. I mean, are we heading into a kind of feudal economy here? Is that what the oligarchy wants? Obedience?
Well, this is what they say is coming. They say that it's going to be really, in their jargon, steeply banked. In other words, if you're at the top, you will get fantastic rewards as a plutocrat. And if you're just a few rungs down, you won't ever be able to afford a house. You probably will stop, your kids will probably stop going to university, period, because they'll see what happened to you, that you went to university and it really didn't do much of anything for you, that you were never really able to buy a home, you know, until maybe you were 50 years old and the kids were out of the house, and even then you didn't earn any money on the home. It didn't really appreciate. So they have this vision of the world is incredibly dystopian, especially in the quote-unquote developed West. They say it's just going to be awful, awful world for you people, and therefore you should decide to be one of the winners. But, of course, the winners aren't even the 1%. It's really the 1/1000th of the 1%. And so young people see this and go, actually, dude, we can do math. that means that 99.999% of us end up losing. We don't like your world. And you are correct. Both of these folks, the CEO, from Wall Street and the spokesperson telling the carrier employees were just affronted, outraged. The people were upset at them.
Well, obviously, there are talk about two Americas. There's a different universe that operating here between the 1% of the 1% and the rest of us. And it is pretty sad that the young kids today, the millennials, some of them, I think, are being conned into believing that the gig economy is a good thing. And you've got people like Uber that I think are capitalized to the tune of about $50 billion on Wall Street or even more. And obviously that's good for the CEO, who's one of these sort of scorched earth libertarians. But these kids that have these gigs that advertise them as being empowered and self-employed, it's just a new form of slavery without any benefits whatsoever. At least the old forms of industrial indenture gave you some benefits.
Well, I'm sure that there are some people fooled, but you can see in the statistics that you were referring to, Bernie is winning even among women, if they're young, by margins of 4-1 over Hillary. So overwhelmingly, the younger folks get it. They aren't dumb, and they figured out that this world that's being shaped for them by these powerful folks is a disaster. And apropos these four famous economists, you know, the former heads of the Council of Economic Advisors and Paul Krugman, they figured out that a big chunk of the Democratic Party, the Clinton wing of the so-called New Democrats, is only modestly different on economic issues. Yeah, they're different on things like gay rights and such. They're very different from the Republicans. And but on the economics, they too, this group of Clintonian Democrat economists, are scared to death of Bernie Sanders. And they went berserk on this poor economist, Gerald Friedman, because he had the nerve to use their own models. This is the models that the Krugmans and the Council of Economic Advisors use routinely, and to plug in Bernie's economic plan, and guess what? It did really well and much, much better than Hillary. And by the way, this economist that they're now trying to basically have a public lynching and destroy his career, he's the only thing person he's contributed money to in this campaign is Hillary Clinton.
Well, again, I'm speaking with William K. Black, a professor of economics and law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. He is a founding member of Bank Whistleblowers United and the author of the best-selling book, The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, Wall Street's Message to Young Adults, You Are Clueless. So clearly, young adults are being motivated and inspired by Bernie Sanders. And the question now is, how long can he stay in? Because essentially the game is pretty much rigged against him from now on. The primary down in Nevada, you know, in effect, you know, the Democratic Party and Hillary Clinton are kind of the umpires. And from now on, he's going to have a really hard time. What do you think is going to happen with his young folks, though? I mean, the Democratic Party, I know they're really clueless, the DNC. They're the ones that came up with this idea, let's bury the debate so we don't want Sanders to do well. So they're going to, you know, figure out how to bury him. But they'll do that at a huge cost. All those young people won't vote for Hillary unless she steps up and welcomes them into her campaign if Bernie doesn't, if he, you know, finds the going tougher from now on, which all the pundits seem to indicate is the decks are stacked against him.
So Hillary gets that she has to move to the left and has been doing that. But what she doesn't get is that the younger people have correctly said Elizabeth Warren is correct. And by the way, this is the position that the Bank Whistleblowers United has taken. And, you know, this is not a bunch of uber socialist types that we just say it flat out. The system is rigged. We've seen it from the inside. And Bernie Sanders is not using mere rhetoric. It is an objective fact that the primary business plan of Wall Street was and remains fraud. Hillary is unwilling to see the system as fundamentally rigged because, of course, it's fundamentally rigged in her favor. And she's part of it keeping rigged that way. So it's unclear whether she will be able to energize a whole bunch of the folks who would support the Democratic Party. But you can guarantee that a bunch of younger Democrats have been seeing these numbers and going, oh my goodness, what an opportunity. I should be talking and supporting and learning from this huge block of voters and bringing them into my future campaign. Of course, not just for president, but for all kinds of offices.
Well, Bernie Sanders does point out how much more powerful the banks are now, how much of the economy they control. And I think you can take that argument even further, which is that Wall Street not only is a rigged casino that's very self-serving, and as the Wall Street, the financialization of our economy continues, it's now over 60%, I understand, and growing. At the end of the day, I think it'll be the death of capitalism because you cannot keep extracting wealth without producing something. You know, they don't produce anything of value, and it's all about extracting wealth, not producing wealth.
Well, we think Bernie can do more as well, and indeed we think he should officially sign on to our plan, which has a whole bunch of very serious steps that we worked out, all of which can be taken without new legislation or with new rulemaking. So it doesn't matter if Bernie Sanders were elected president and the Republicans controlled the House and the Senate. He could still implement these steps to restore the rule of law, to get rid of the too big to fail, and to bring back a modern version of Glass-Steagall by using the authority that we've had for over 25 years to set individual minimum capital requirements. And we would also call on not just Bernie, but all candidates to support those planks, but to restore the rule of law, but also to sign on to our campaign funding pledge, which says stop taking money from the financial felons. And you are correct. The efficiency condition for a middleman, and that's what finance is, a middleman, is to be lean and mean. And instead, it is back up near the absolute levels that it reached just before the Great Depression and just before the most recent financial disaster, of about 40% of total profits of all industries in the United States. And what that tells you is that finance is actually acting now as a parasite as opposed to an effective middleman. So it is, conservative economists always talk about the metaphor of the economy as the pie, and we shouldn't worry so much about how it's divided. We should worry, is it getting bigger? Well, finance now makes the pie much smaller. It actually decreases the size of the economy, and it takes an unbelievably unfair share of the pie. And that's why, as you say, it comes back to what we were saying earlier. That's why we have this gig economy in which we have a race to the bottom that is already laid out flat, the working class in America, and has shrunk the middle class substantially and caused them at best to stall for now 25 years. Even those who haven't lost simply have not gained statistically in a quarter century in America.
But I think that's the point, that the broader point that you just made, that I wish that in many ways Bernie made, even though he gives us the statistics, that Wall Street has become parasitic, as you pointed out. The insurance industry and the Affordable Care Act that Bernie says we can do better with a single payer, the logic of single payer is that you do cut out the middleman. Insurance companies are an unnecessary and parasitic layer between the patient and the caregiver, and they bring nothing to the table. They just take stuff away, and that's exactly what Wall Street has become. Instead of becoming an engine of capitalism, they've become this vast parasite. And the same is true, by the way, of the speculators who drive up the price of oil, and they're starting to drive it up again. And they actually attack the pocketbook of every working and middle-class American by running up the price of food and running up the price of gasoline. And these are the rules of the casino there on Wall Street. The insiders can do all this stuff with impunity, and that's what has become their mentality, I think, that they just basically are out there to screw everybody else, and how dare you criticize us.
Well, and unfortunately, that's been picked up by Hillary, that it is disloyal to criticize President Obama for anything, that he has become Saint Obama. And, you know, that's ridiculous. And obviously, he has done some things that are really wrong, or more precisely, failed to do some things that were critical, like his record in prosecuting the banksters that led the fraud epidemics that caused the crisis is indefensible, just literally indefensible. There's never been a strategic failure this great in law enforcement in the modern era of the United States of America. And to add to your point on insurance, which I agree with in the health context, on top of that, when you have private health insurance, you make your businesses much less competitive internationally. So it's a really stupid system that we need to get away with. Everyone knows, everyone can look at the numbers, right? And the numbers for decades have showed that we spend twice as much to get inferior health consequences compared to, you know, virtually all the rest of the developed world. And on top of that, we ban the government from negotiating effectively on drug prices. That is actually forbidden by statute, which is why we also overpay massively on drugs and have by far the highest prices for drugs anywhere in the world.
And everybody sort of points to that little creep Shreckley, who jacked up the price of, of life-saving drugs by 5,000%, as though he's somehow an outlier, when he is the business model.
Well, he's increasingly the business model, and it comes back to the broader point we're talking about. He's a hedge fund guy. Actually, according to the Justice Department, he's a fraudulent hedge fund guy.
Right.
So this is exactly the mentality that, you know, many, many people, for centuries literally, have gone into healthcare because they actually frequently cared about people and wanted to improve their health. Hedge fund guys get in for the sole purpose, and think any other purpose is absurd, of making themselves unbelievably wealthy at the direct expense of the patient.
Well, Bill Black, I guess we can only hope that Bernie Sanders stays around a lot longer to get his message across, because it's the first time I think anybody across this country has heard of an alternative to the very narrow political choices we've had now for decades. And
well, I think we can do more than that. I think we can encourage other people to come forward as well. I think that the younger Americans will take their place in leadership roles, saying no to the gig economy. And I think much of their message will be similar to what Bernie has tapped into. But I think, of course, much of their message will also be from their life experience. And they will, you know, if you think Bernie is winning big as a, you know, not young person, imagine what an effective millennial leader will do who taps into this same vein and speaks to people from, you know, exactly the life experiences that they share. I think he or she, or they, I hope, of both genders, many of them will come forward, and that we can support them as well.
Well, I can't wait for that to happen, and I thank you very much for joining us, William Black.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with William K. Black, who's a professor of economics and law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and the former litigation director of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, who investigated the savings and loan disaster of the 1980s. A white-collar criminologist, he's a founding member of Bank Whistleblowers United and the author of the best-selling book, The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, Wall Street's Message to Young Adults, You Are Clueless. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the South Carolina Democratic primaries and the latest spat between Rubio and Cruz. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is David Woodard, who is a professor of political science at Clemson University and the author of The New Southern Politics and Ronald Reagan, a biography. He's also a political consultant for Republican candidates whose clients have included Senator Jim DeMint, Senator Lindsey Graham, former Congressman Gresham Barrett, Congressman Trey Gowdy, and Congressman Jeff Duncan. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Woodard.
Thank you, Ian.
And I guess to some extent the circus has left town, but you've got another one coming in with the Democrats in South Carolina on Saturday. But for all of the talk about how rough politics are in South Carolina and how much mudslinging goes on, it sounds like already in terms of the Republican race in the for the Nevada caucuses on Tuesday, things have turned quite ugly between Senators Rubio and Cruz. Have you been following the latest?
No, I haven't heard the latest, but I'm not at all surprised.
Well, apparently, what's happened is that Ted Cruz has been forced to fire his media director, who was one of the first hires that he had. And apparently it's to do with a sort of somewhat doctored video that mischaracterizes Rubio as being essentially trashing the Bible. So it's quite it's quite a turn of events here. So this is I'm just giving you the latest headlines now, and Ted Cruz has had to come out and apologize and fire this fellow who used to be the media director for Newt Gingrich, who was his first hire, a guy called Rick Tyler. So that's the latest buzz. But I guess
well, I kind of thought that Rubio got a bounce out of South Carolina. He got a lot of endorsements down here. He only won by 1,071 votes to claim second. But I think it sort of picked him up and picked up his campaign. So this is a blow for Cruz because he needed to keep up the momentum if he was going to keep going. So we'll see.
Well, the other thing that surely that hurts Cruz is that Carson still stays in the race. And doesn't Carson drain votes from Cruz?
Yes, he does. And I thought Bush getting out would probably help. Well, it would help both candidates to sort of get one candidate out. But I thought Carson for sure would leave because just of where he finished down the list. But I think most people are still thinking in old terms, and this is not a race that's going to be decided in 4 weeks or 5 weeks like it has been in the past. The new change in laws, which give South Carolina for the first time proportional delegates, means that candidates can finish second, third, fourth, and still stay in the race until the winner-take-all begins on March 15th. So we still have a few more weeks of it.
So are you saying, though, David Woodard, that this could go all the way to the convention?
I really don't think that. I think the winner-take-all votes will make the decision down after the 15th. I've read several stories on that. I've sort of rolled my eyes each time. Only 5% of the votes for Republicans have been decided now. So really, the 95% is still out there. Now, I know March 4th and March 5th are going to be big days, but my point is if the puzzle gets a little clearer on those days, I think we'll go back to the old way of having a nominee by the time we go to the convention.
So you're not then taking the position that Trump is invincible on a roll, he's won by wide margins. You don't think that that's indicative of a future trajectory for Trump?
Well, I think it takes a while for some of these things to kind of sink in. And I'm not expecting Trump to win the nomination, although I know what the polls say. I mean, I'm a pollster. I study that every day. I understand how things are going. But I sense a real loss of momentum here, despite the fact that he won in South Carolina. There were a lot of reservations by people after the campaign left about having nominated him.
So what's the nature of that buyer's remorse coming so early after what seemed like a pretty heady victory?
Well, 32%. Our polls had him at under 30%. 32% is okay, but some of the polls had him at 35. I think some of the people who participated haven't felt on his side, haven't felt a real wrath from other Republicans like they're beginning to feel now that it's over. There are prominent Republicans around the state in the newspapers and on the blogs today talking about how embarrassed they are for South Carolina, talking about their own interviews with Trump and how he avoided telling them certain things. There's been sort of a blowback since that's over. Now, again, I know that doesn't change the outcome, but it might be the beginning of more of a critical choppy water ahead for him than it has been in the past.
And again, I'm speaking with David Woodard, who's a professor of political science at Clemson University and the author of The New Southern Politics and Ronald Reagan, a biography. He's also a political consultant for Republican candidates whose clients have included Senator Jim DeMint, Senator Lindsey Graham, former Congressman Gresham Barrett, Congressman Trey Gowdy, and Congressman Jeff Duncan. But given what's going on now between Cruz and Rubio, and let's face it, from day one, Donald Trump has not been shy to, with the sharp elbows and the barbed tongue. It's starting to sort of trickle down to the other two, isn't it?
Well, I think if one of them could drop out, the other one would probably be in first place. Mm-hmm. They're all feeding from the same pool. The Trump supporters are off over to one side. There are enough of them, and they're enthusiastic enough. Like I said, our poll projected 28%. We were using people who voted in previous Republican primaries. It's clear to get to 32 or 33 here in South Carolina. Trump is attracting a lot of other people in the vote in the Republican primary for the first time. I just wonder how long he can continue to put that kind of stock in his campaign, because at some point it's going to wear out.
But that would suggest to me, David Woodard, that in a way the Republicans have the same problem that the Democrats have with Bernie Sanders. Is Bernie Sanders is bringing in a lot of new and particularly young and enthusiastic voters, and they're certainly going to be less enthusiastic about voting for Hillary Clinton. And on the Republican side, Trump is bringing out all kinds of people who haven't voted before. A lot of them are independents, but they are obviously voting in a Republican primary. So you don't want to discourage those people at the end of the day, do you? You want to keep them in the tent.
Yes, I'd like to keep them in the tent. But you kind of wonder if it comes down to a general election between Hillary Clinton and either a Cruz or a Rubio, would they really go to Hillary Clinton? And you think that even though Trump brought them in, they wouldn't do that. Now, they may not vote, but if they do vote, they're going to vote Republican. I think that's the feeling of the establishment. it's just a very confused picture this year, much different than it has been in South Carolina. And I'm still thinking that what happened last year, where this state was one of only two to select Newt Gingrich, is going to happen again, that there's a lot of remorse after it was over, and it didn't really change the outcome.
So let's turn to the Democrats then, David Woodard. What's the latest on the ground there in terms of Bernie Sanders, who's got a bit of an uphill climb in terms of winning over the predominantly African-American vote on the Democratic?
Right, that's right, Ian. Yeah. Most of the South Carolina remembers the Hillary Clinton of 2008. They liked her then. They probably would have voted for her, except Barack Obama came down here and campaigned personally, began to get a lot of white voters. About 60% of the turnout in the Democratic primary is African American. Many of them came over to Obama's side, and then white voters came as well. And as a result, they defeated Hillary down here, and that really turned her campaign down. So I think this time Hillary is doing very well. Our polls show that she's doing very well. Bernie Sanders has been down here organizing, but he just didn't have any of the machinery behind him. The only elected congressman, majority black district, Jim Clyburn, endorsed Hillary Clinton today. So I think that pretty much seals that Hillary is going to win South Carolina.
And what do you think, by what kind of margin? Because that's Bernie Sanders did cut down her enormous lead in Nevada quite considerably. She only won by about 5 or 6 points, and I think she's like 20-something ahead prior
right.
to that.
We show a more substantial lead down here for Hillary, and it has not eroded, not since November. So I'm thinking that she's safe. I know there's going to be a big push by Bernie. I'm not saying it's going to be 20 points, but I'm going to say it's going to be a comfortable victory for Hillary Clinton.
And what about this idea of a third party candidate coming in? Do you think the conditions are right for a Bloomberg? Is it looking? I mean, previously you suggested that it won't be a deadlock convention, so I don't see a place for him, is there?
Well, I think if Trump continues to do well, you're going to see a lot of Republicans leave the Republican Party and look for somebody else. And I think this is, as we all know about third-party candidates, usually not a successful way, because all that you can really do is you usually don't win a state. The two major parties win most of the electoral votes, but you're able to register a protest with the nominee. And that may be the case if Trump gets the nomination. I think that will be the case.
But that's to suggest that Kasich is not going to have legs, right?
Right, and that's kind of based on down here. To be a Republican, you have to win two geographical areas, the South and the Midwest. The fact that Kasich was not able to contend very well in South Carolina, and with the states coming up, Tennessee, Alabama, Georgia, major states in the South, if he doesn't contend here, he will have lost a major geographical base for the party, and I don't see that being helpful for him at all.
But if Trump does do well and stays, you know, does as well as he's been doing, and there's a lot of predictions that he will do well on Super Tuesday and after that, what is there? What ammunition does the so-called Republican establishment have in terms of blocking him?
Well, they can say he's not a Republican. That's one of the things.
Well, they can say, but Hillary can say that about Bernie Sanders, and it doesn't do a lot of good.
That's right. You know. That's right. I mean, I think it's very difficult to know what the future is going to be, and I think if Trump does very well on the 1st and the 5th of March, I think there will be quite a crisis of a concern amongst the Republican elite. And that means elected officials who are in Washington, in Congress, in Senate, in the House, beginning to voice their own opinions, as well as, you know, previous candidates. I don't think you're going to have to do much to get Jeb Bush to talk about Donald Trump And there may be some others besides that.
So what about the other wild card that's often discussed, and particularly in terms of if Trump does very well, then there's, you know, if there's not a brokered convention, there's certainly a divided one. The reemergence of Mitt Romney. Do you give that any credence?
I doubt if he would be he would be the nominee. The rumor today was that he was going to endorse Rubio, but Rubio said he had never heard that. And I think maybe one of the reasons why Mitt Romney is stepping back is because he's seeing all this confusion going on, and he wants to step aside to see if something could come his way. I really don't think that would work very well either. But I mean, I really think that unless something is resolved with these two other candidates falling, you know, getting out and just leaving the battle amongst the top three, then I think we could be in for some real trouble. I'm not one yet to speak for a brokered convention, but I am one to say that I think a lot of the tension went up with the death of Scalia and the close race here, in which Rubio was able to outdo Cruz, where our polls had Cruz in second. So I would be surprised if somebody doesn't break out in the establishment, which would be either Cruz or Rubio, and try and take on Trump.
But for all the talk about how Trump could take down the Republican Party and this could be a disastrous year for the Republicans, what goes against that logic is the enormous turnout that is happening in Iowa, and I take it also in South Carolina.
It wasn't that high turnout. It was 675,000, which is what you could have sort of expected.
Mm-hmm.
We've had higher than that in 2000. We had higher turnout than that.
Mm-hmm.
I think the reason why the turnout was down in the Republican Party is because there's a real fracas going on the Democratic Party, and so the Democrats did not cross over to vote in the Republican Party like they sometimes do. So it was not that heavy a turnout, and I think the problem was that there were some new voters. That the only campaign that seemed to be able to reach them was Trump.
So you don't think then that the Republicans are fired up this year? You mentioned Scalia as a possible issue that might spark some motivation.
Well, I guess because of political scientist, I hoped it would spark some motivation, but it didn't seem to so far.
Right.
But like I said, there's a saturation effect to some of these issues. It takes a few days for them to sink in. I think we'll all be watching out there to see how things go in Nevada, and then that will be the prelude to March 1st. I think by the end of March 1st, we'll have 40% of the delegates selected. That should tell the tale as to how that's going to go. And if it's still very muddled, I think we could have a brokered convention. I'd begin to say that after March 1st. Between now and March 1st, I think I'd better withhold my fire.
Okay. Well, David Woodard, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
And thank you very much. I'll see you down the road. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with David Woodard, who's a professor of political science at Clemson University and author of The New Southern Politics and Ronald Reagan, A Biography. He's also a political consultant for Republican candidates whose clients have included Senator Jim DeMint, Senator Lindsey Graham, former Congressman Gresham Barrett, Congressman Trey Gowdy, and Congressman Jeff Duncan. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.